ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley from ABC News Daily, the podcast that brings you one big story affecting your world each weekday in just 15 minutes.
At some point, a global recession will bring the AI boom to an end, temporarily at least, but the world has changed forever.
Join me for ABC News Daily. Find us on ABC Listen.
This podcast was produced on the lands of the Awabakal and Gadigal people. G'day, Matt Bevan here. This is If You're Listening. We've just done two back-to-back episodes on the controversial US data analytics company Palantir, which for the past 3 years has been leveraging AI technology to streamline lots of different organizations that need to handle a lot of data, from supermarket chains to intelligence agencies to the US military. It just so happens that just after we finished doing these two episodes, the ABC has hired its first ever AI reporter. And I'm led to believe that this is a human reporter who reports on what's going on with AI. We're not handing the national broadcaster over to Claude and ChatGPT just yet. The ABC's inaugural national AI reporter is Cam Wilson, who has been on the show before talking about his recent book, Conspiracy Nation. He's also been at Crikey doing reporting on tech companies for several years now. And he's just broken a story about the way Australian intelligence agencies are using Palantir. Cam Wilson, welcome back to the ABC. How's the first week going? What's going on in AI news so far, you know?
Oh, you know, there's a bit of news about, as you might have seen. I've been very excited for this role because I've been a tech reporter now for the better part of a decade. And over the last definitely 2 years and pretty much since the release of ChatGPT at the end of 2022, when it was actually just like a little research preview that kind of blew up the internet and got everyone super interested in it. You know, all of tech news in that time has really become AI news. So, you know, unofficially, I kind of became a bit of an AI reporter, but it's nice to get the nice title at the ABC now.
We've just wrapped up our Palantir series covering the company's origins and the controversial views of its CEO, Alex Karp, in our episode that came out on Thursday. If you missed those episodes, go back and listen to them now, because what Cam and I are about to discuss will make a lot more sense if you've heard those episodes. But we were mainly focusing on Palantir's activities in the US, but of course they are also doing work for allied countries as well, like Australia. And when did Palantir first get involved here? It was before AI chatbots were a thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, long before. Palantir as a company has been working for the Australian government, winning contracts and doing work for them for more than a decade now. I think it's the early 2010s. And they've done a work with a variety of agencies.
I'm embarrassed to say that when I read your story about this, it involved an Australian intelligence agency that I did not know existed. Tell me about ACIC, the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission.
Yeah, so Palantir started doing work with them, I think first with them actually for their predecessor organization. There's been, you know, a government agency that has been dedicated to tracking organized crime in Australia. And this is the one that has, like, I believe, the longest relationship with Palantir, which kind of makes sense because, you know, as you can probably tell from the name, you know, the intelligence in it, like, their job is tracking these nefarious organizations that operate, you know, within Australia and I guess outside as well. And what Palantir does is honestly a bit of a, like, kind of consulting technology company that is helping various organizations, a lot of governments, a lot of big companies to make sense of their data. And, you know, that fundamentally isn't really that kind of scary in and of itself. And
no, it's not inherently sinister.
It sounds quite boring, to be honest. So, I mean, it's kind of incredible that they get so much attention now. So, you know, bringing it back around to this first agency, you know, you've got this, you know, agency tracking this kind of crime that involves a lot of people, a lot of surveillance data, like all those kinds of things.
Are we basically talking about bikies? We're talking about...
Yeah, that's right. And so what they're doing is, you know, we can see what Palantir does is these agencies are the ones who get the data. You know, they have the warrants, the information gathering powers and capabilities. And then they go to Palantir and they say, help us make sense of all this. Like, help us, you know, bring it together, visualize it in different ways. All these things, again, that when you kind of say out loud, you know, they kind of sound abstract. But what's trying to do is being like, how do we join these people up? How do we prove who's connected to who and what's doing what? That is why, you know, ACIC has been really involved in them. And of course, naturally, that's why you see their involvement in a lot of agencies and departments that do intelligence and national security stuff.
Now, you, through Freedom of Information request in your final weeks at Crikey, managed to get a hold of something very exciting, which is the instruction manual for Gotham, which is Palantir's software that they basically sell to intelligence agencies and military organizations, which is the thing that they use to gather all that information and make it understandable to an analyst who works at a place like the ACIC or, or the FBI or the CIA or whatever like that. You, unlike most dudes, read the instruction manual.
Yes, yes, trust me. I don't do it in my personal life.
No, but, of course not. No,
this is a professional thing, so I did have to crack it open. Yeah, no,
How big is it? Is it like, you know, the one of the ones you get for your new car or?
Actually, that's a good question. I recently did just look at my car manual. A little bit smaller than that, but, you know, pretty thick. What I got is this manual, and I looked through it and tried to understand it. And, you know, crucially, this isn't just a manual for just how to use their product. What Palantir does is it's more than just a, hey, here's a software license, like, I guess, Microsoft, you know, Office 365. They have this service where they give you this software, but they also integrate it into your systems. They, you know, they send staff into these departments and agencies to help make sense of the data because, you know, again, it's actually quite a big process to actually be like, we've got to pull it out from all the places and get in the one place so that then you can actually analyze it for the eye-popping numbers that these contracts between Palantir and various government agencies go for. You know, you would expect a little bit of, I guess, white glove service, the customization. So, yeah, so, I mean, it was super interesting because it just showed exactly how it works and, you know, what they're actually, what Palantir is selling to people, why they actually do get these government agencies, not just to use them once, but seemingly to come back, you know, often time and time again. And to put it simply, you know, it was talking all about all of the nuts and bolts of being like, okay, you're an intelligence agency. You've got all this stuff. How do we actually help you make sense of that stuff? The manual that I saw said that ACIC had 42 million data points that they were trying to organize. But, you know, if you're looking to, you know, XY family, XY gang, you know, trying to make sense of that. And it had information about, like, you could map the relationships between people. You could use it to generate timelines. You could do even like geographical heat maps where you're like, you could look at a map and be like, you know, the calls are here, here, and here, and this is where all the things are happening. And that's apparently what Palantir is very good at, is creating these products that analysts feel that it's very simple to use.
Well, it feels like the software that we see fictional cops and investigators use on, you know, NCIS. And,
that's right.
You know, they go, oh, has this person ever spoken to that person? And then they just go tappy, tappy, tap, and then here's all the information. Or, you know, let's get all the cameras between this position and that position. There they are.
Yep.
So, you know, it's kind of something that in the world of fiction they've had for years. But in the world of reality, you know, in order to investigate things, you were talking about individual files, having to go and request files from other agencies, read them yourself with your human, you know, fleshy human eyeballs, and try and draw connections out of these things, whereas this is trying to bring all those things together onto a single screen. Right.
Exactly right. It's like, speaking of Gotham in, you know, The Dark Knight when... Sorry, I'm going to spoil this 15-year-old movie for anyone.
Oh, no.
Where at the end, where they've turned all the phones into, like, a tracking device and they see it out all over the map. That's the kind of stuff. And, you know, that is a really difficult thing to do because, like, you know, now all of us, you know, even think individually, we're all casting off all kinds of data. But if you've ever tried to, like, you know, if many services, in fact, I think all services in Australia are supposed to have the option to be able to say, hey, under privacy law, you've got to give me what data you have on me. They give it to you and it's not really useful. Like, it's usually just like a table of stuff and you're like, I can't really make heads or tails of this.
I've done this, and there's two things that I realize about it. One is that generally it's an enormous amount of information. But the other thing is that almost none of it is interesting. You know, if I was to gather information on you, Cam, I could get all of your information, but it would take me an enormous amount of time to find the things that I actually, you know, am looking for. But you found something interesting in terms of the settings that the manual was encouraging agents to use. Because obviously, you know, we all have different folders that we keep information in. Here at If You're Listening, we have, you know, folders on a cloud drive that the people who work on this show have access to. You know, certainly the public can't just look at all of our files, and even people in other parts of the ABC can't look at our files. You have to be given permission. But what were you finding inside of this instruction manual in terms of how that worked inside Palantir's system at the ACIC?
Look, Matt, I'm not going to ask you what you're hiding. I'll stick to this the script, but, you know, just saying, it sounds like you got some secrets.
He knows too much.
All right. Sorry. I'm turning it back on you. I am the host now.
You've been here a few days, Cam. You can't take my job just yet. Just
I'm
wait.
I'm getting pretty big for my boots. Yeah, so look, the Palantir contract had described the software, and again, this is the custom for this agency, to leave the data open to as many people as possible. By default, leaving it unavailable to everyone. Now, the context for that is, you know, as you kind of mentioned, in most organizations and generally under Australian privacy law, there's a principle that it's just like the only people who need to have access to data should have it. Like, you know, particularly when you're dealing with delicate things and, you know, the stuff that they're putting into Palantir, intercepted phone calls, locations, intelligence briefs that they've just manually worked on, that is presumably the kind of highest level of private information. Now, I don't have much insight into ACIC and these other intelligence agencies. And just to mention, of course, like contacted them and they had nothing to say further about this. But the fact that they were just like, you know, leave it open is interesting, to be clear. I'm not accusing this agency of breaking those rules. I don't know the exact way that it is arranged. And you can understand why an agency would want all this data to be available for people within the organization, because if you're connecting, you know, the dots, you need the dots to be available to connect. And it might be, you know, one of the challenges that no doubt they have is like being like, well, not only does do we have the data, but are we allowed to use the data? That being said, you know, this is one of the interesting tensions of when you get private enterprise working very closely with government, where, you know, companies in many cases can do a lot more than government and, you know, particularly generally get less oversight than government. And so, like, you know, their inclination, no doubt, is to maximize, well, how useful can our product be? How good can Palantir be in joining the dots? So they want to set everything open.
Yes.
You know, I think it's reasonable to ask, you know, even in an agency where, you know, you're hoping that they have access to the good data that they need to fight crime, how are they protecting this information? How are they making sure that even, you know, within the agency that people who are looking into one thing don't necessarily have access to unrelated data? Because that is part of making sure that you don't end up with, you know, violating people's privacy, which does have real consequences. And I think it's worth just kind of contextualizing it within, like, what do you think about third-party contractors are doing for government? You know, they are providing a service that government can't provide, and they're supposed to win things through a tender process to make sure it's competitive, that, you know, the taxpayer is getting the best value for money, that they're getting the best service, all of those things. The criticism leveled at Palantir outside of its more controversial purposes is the way that has been very good at entrenching itself in governments. You know, the UK in particular is a great example of it. Obviously, the US as well. I think in the UK, they've handed over a couple hundred million pound contract between Defence and Palantir recently. In the US, they've just signed a US $1 billion contract with one of the agencies. And I think, you know, it follows this pattern of getting in early, starting to do things, and then expanding. They call this process the kind of land and expand. You get in, you win an initial contract, and then you use that to kind of do more and more work, swallow things up, and also to become like indispensable. Because, you know, if you think about it, like when Palantir is doing work, a public servant isn't doing it, or another company isn't doing it, for example, perhaps an Australian company who exists entirely within Australia and is only under Australian law.
Then, I mean, that sounds great, but does that company exist? Palantir's entire pitch is that we have essentially no competitors. We provide a service that nobody else can provide. So either sign the contract or be prepared to continue looking through files by hand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, sorting through, you know, searching on your iPhone for like, It's a great point. And I think, you know, I have had a chance to chat to some people with knowledge of this stuff, including an analyst in the defense community who is working for the government but is not authorized to speak publicly.
Sure.
You know, their view is like Palantir stuff is fine. It's on par with other stuff. But even if it is like maybe a bit better, you know, one of the complicated things about all of this is there are these trade-offs where, you know, you want to catch the bad guys, you want to use the best stuff, but you also want to be like, what are the flow-on effects of us using a certain company? We're giving them money, of course, they're building up their capacity. And this trade-off of being like, well, they are this company with these particularly, you know, very, very strident views on the superiority of, you know, the West and specifically the US. And what does that mean? Should Australia not be as close to the US or whatever? It does make it very complicated. Like I said, one analyst, you know, mentioned to me saying, I don't think their products aren't really that good. And sometimes they're too overpowered for the task that they're doing.
Interesting.
It's like trying to kill a mosquito with a Rolls Royce. Like sometimes we get these contracts that are being signed by high up in departments and even politicians who want the best stuff. You know, they want the cool Palantir for all the bad rep. You know, it's also a great advertising campaign because, you know, when you hear about this agency that's so powerful and that people are worried about it, you're like, well, I'd love to have that agency doing my work.
Yeah.
All these reasons make you, you know, question outside of the controversy, like how is the, you know, the Australian state becoming dependent on another a company that has its own commercial interests and perhaps as well, you know, political interests that might diverge from Australia's at some point, and what happens if that does?
Yeah, but I mean, I guess the counterpoint to that would be, isn't that just the way that Australia's defence strategy works?
Mm-hmm.
You know, over the last couple of decades, if not more, we've basically gone, well, we can't make our own fighter jets, so we'll buy in on the Joint Strike Fighter program. We can't make our own nuclear submarines, so we'll sign up to the AUKUS agreement. It just seems to be the way that it works if you are a middle power with a small population in an interesting part of the world like we are.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, again, very clearly they are very good at what they do. So, you know, this isn't just, you know, some kind of surreptitious takeover through other means for no other reason. But the things that I kind of was drawing attention to in the reporting is once you get past the kind of what are they, you know, doing is also, you know, they often get like very favorable contract terms that I was told aren't given to other Australian companies or competitors.
I saw this in your article. It was some pretty amazing things. Their liability is kind of limited to $100,000 or something like that. They've got a very, you know, if something goes terribly wrong, the maximum they have to pay is almost nothing. Did I read that if there's some dispute between us and them, it has to be settled in an English court?
Yeah, arbitration in London. So, I mean, might be nice to have the trip over, but yeah, again, you know, and that gets to the sovereignty thing, you know. By having this kind of relationship, very, very entrenched relationship with a company that fundamentally is not just in Australia, you know, it operates out of somewhere else, does open us up as a vulnerability. And the question is, you know, to what extent is that worth it? And if it is worth it, you know, how do you then, as a government who's got to deal with all of these competing factors, how do you weigh it up? Because, you know, coming back to the thing that I was saying just before, which is like, at the end of the day, I would love it if the government is very good at catching bad guys. But trying to kind of like value it and measure up all these different factors to be like, well, maybe if they're like 5% less good at catching bad guys, but there's a 30% less chance that like they could turn code on us and be acting for a foreign government. It's incredibly complex. But I do think that it is Palantir's growing involvement, both in, you know, these government agencies, businesses as well in Australia, the fact that the government owns part of it, I think has not actually got that much scrutiny. And even if we decide all of it is fine in the end, at least it's something that we really should be paying attention to, so we are clear-eyed about what we are not getting into, but what we have already gotten ourselves into.
It's also a foreign company that just could collapse, you know?
Yeah.
There's all this talk about there being this enormous AI bubble, and there's no reason why Palantir couldn't just go out of business like any other company, and it seems like a big chunk of our intelligence agencies are now relying on it.
I'm sure they've got a couple of floppy disks around that they've backed it up to.
Yeah, backup version. Yeah, that's right. Cam, really interesting story, and glad you're on board here at the ABC to watch this very interesting period that we are entering into as we assess what it means for geopolitics, global security, and the labour market, of course, most of all.
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting.
Yes, a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Matt.
On Thursday, we're shifting our gaze from Palantir over to China. During his meeting with Donald Trump, Xi Jinping made some ominous statements about Taiwan and the potential for conflict if questions over the sovereignty of the island are, quote, handled poorly. So what is Xi Jinping's plan here? And is it likely to work? That's coming up on Thursday. I'll see you then.